Agenda is healthcare reform.
Session 3, healthcare reform. Margaret Buckler, Human Resources Director, will describe the proposed changes and the effect those changes will have on the city's plan, structure, and costs. Ms. Buckler.
Thank you. I'm surrounded by carols. 1, 2, 3. I won the prize today, I guess. We're going to talk a little bit about healthcare reform and what we're looking at as an impact on the city or the things that we're having to talk about. Healthcare reform's just almost a full-time job. There's a lot of things that we don't know yet, and a lot of things that we're going to have to figure out as we go. We're waiting on lots of different final regulations on lots of different pieces, and it changes. It's like a moving target. But we'll go through, mainly I want to talk about the timeline and some of the things that we're going to have to think about. Carol Wilson is the person in my office that manages the benefits, and so if I'm really stupid about one piece of it, she knows more than I do. So I'll defer if I need to. There are three things in your materials. One is the United Healthcare's guide on healthcare reform and the implementation and what that means. You've got another document about the 2014 major issues that Gallagher Benefit Services did. And then the last thing is our 5-26-11 United Healthcare Affordability Scorecard, and I'll use that at the end just to give you an example of what plan design changes can do on your bottom line. But for healthcare reform, we're already into it. We made changes in 2011 for things that we had to do, and I'll talk a little bit about what we did for 2011. But first I want to talk about grandfathered and non-grandfathered plans. The original set of law said that if you remained what they called a grandfathered plan, a lot of these things would not apply to you. But what grandfathered means is you can't make any changes at all with premium amounts or anything. And so we went through the process last year and through the budget process, and as we got ready to do the 2001 changes and made a conscious decision to not be grandfathered because we lost control completely of what the plan design would be and what we can charge and all of those things. So we are a non-grandfathered plan, and we're still in charge of our own destiny at the point. Last year, in 2010, we had a really decent year. 2011 is not looking as good just because of large claim liability, but we think we're going to come in under the radar. There are several things in 2011, and most of these things we've already done. But we're also in the temporary early retiree reinsurance program. We were one of the entities that was approved to participate in that. That's the $5 million fund that they've set aside that when the money's over, the money's over. And it applies to pre-65 retirees with claims from $15,000 to $90,000, I believe, that are Medicare eligible, whatever that means. We did get approved. We're going through a process right now, and Carol's working with United Healthcare and Caremark to get our claims together. We think we have about $84,000 that we can submit under that program. So that's a good thing. But we found out yesterday, day before, I think, that they're down to $2.5 million left in the fund. So we're working as quickly as we can to get our application in for that. So that's one aspect that's having a positive effect on us. The other things that happened this year is adult children, we have to cover them to age 26 now. That has an impact on our plan costs, and we figured that in as we went into the year that we're in now. United Healthcare did some calculations on the cost of those sorts of things, and they say at a high that's about a 1 to 1.5% increase on plan costs, and we put on how many? 35 add-ons came under that for our plan. So that could have an impact on our bottom line. We had a ban on pre-existing conditions for children that went into effect for this plan year, a ban on rescissions. We can't cut anybody out. And then the ban on annual and lifetime limits, that we had a $2 million lifetime limit in 2010. In 2011, we now don't have a lifetime limit, and I believe the calculation on that was an increase to the plan cost of about 0.6%.
Excuse me. I'm sorry if I missed this, if you said it, but rescissions are what?
Are if we, if somebody is mistakenly put onto the plan, but they're not really qualified to be on our plan, we cannot go back to the date. We cannot retroactively take them off. We have to take them off as of the day that we have discovered it's a mistake.
I see. And this would be what, like a dependent that isn't really a dependent, or?
Just anybody that's not eligible to be on our plan for whatever reason. Administratively, we've got them on our plan.
I'm trying to think of who it might be, except for, say, the county had that issue where the workers quit and they continue to pay.
We had the same kind of issue.
Right.
It's that sort of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody could tell us that they are qualified, and we find out later that they're really
not.
They're not in a benefited position.
I'm kind of confused about that, but maybe it's not worth going into at this level of detail.
If you have got questions, you can let me know, and we'll go over that. Coverage for preventive services was required, and we did quite a bit of that, so we don't think that's going to have much of an impact. We had to have an independent appeals process, and we really already did, but it just formalized it. Our line of appeal for health care claims denial is first line is United Healthcare's appeal process, and then we have our own, and then we have a board. But we think that this independent appeal decision does make our health care advisory board, appeal board, kind of moot. So one of the things that we're going to probably recommend is to eliminate that board at some point. A ban on discrimination based on salary, we don't have an issue with that because we don't have any highly compensated plan people. We've never also choice of primary care provider. We've never required anybody to choose, so that didn't affect us. Advance notice of material modification of benefits, we're to give notice when we're going to do that.
60 days?
60-day notice. We do that anyway, so we don't think that that's a problem. One of the other things that happened this year on our flexible spending account, over-the-counter medications are no longer eligible for flexible spending expenses unless they're prescribed. Then there's a Medicare coverage gap discount program that we still don't get.
Correct.
And so it doesn't really apply for that. And then one thing that's still hanging out there is an automatic enrollment in our health plan. They've not defined what that means. What a full-time employee is. And so there aren't rules on that. We pretty much do automatically enroll, but what this will require us to automatically enroll everyone that's eligible for coverage, and they'll have to opt out as soon as we know what that means. So that's still hanging out there. For 2011, some of the things that we did to try and mitigate things were add a higher deductible copay plan that mirrors our $750, so we've got a $1,500. We also added, as you know, the high deductible health plan. And how many people enrolled in that?
In the high deductible, we have 45.
45, which is more than we thought we'd get. So there are people that are embarking on that.
And so that's an option for employees if they want to pay a lower premium?
Correct.
Nice.
We also have increased our co-insurance, and we increased our out-of-pocket maximums. We're going through the whole process. For 2012, there are a few things that will come up. One is the uniform summary of plan benefits and coverage that we'll be required to do, and that isn't a great big deal. We pretty much have that done. The one thing that has cost to it is the patient-centered outcomes research fee, and it's $1 per member per year. So for 2012, we'll have to pay $2,500.
I'm having a little trouble following where you are on this thing.
It isn't really very good.
So could you repeat that? I'm sorry to...
Okay. The patient-centered, this is for changes in 2012. And that we don't have a real good chart for it, but it's called the patient-centered outcome research fee. It's a dollar per member per year, so that includes dependents. So in a round number, it's only $2,500. That goes up to $2 per member per year in 2013. So that would be $5,000. Not in a fund the size that we have, that's not what we would consider significant. Then we also have uniform summary of plan benefits and coverage and quality of care reporting requirement. Those are just things that really will impact our relationship with UnitedHealthcare and with Caremark right now, who does our drug benefit. So there's not much coming in 2012 but for managing costs, and I'll talk about that just briefly in a minute.
Did you skip the W-2 reporting?
W-2 reporting is as of January 2013 for plan year 2012, and we're working for calendar year. So we are working with finance on that, but that'll be really an impact that finance has to deal with. You have to report drug benefits as of January 2013 for 2012. So that's a function that we're going to have to report.
Does that mean they'll be taxable?
No. It's not going to be taxable, but it has to be reported.
Okay.
So 2013, there's not a ton of stuff that's going to affect us as a plan. Medicare tax increase for high earners probably won't impact us. No deduction for retiree drug subsidy will change the way that the Medicare Part D stuff is managed. One big thing that's not in our plan but does impact our flexible spending accounts is the health limit will go from $5,000 to $2,500, so that's a big change. And then what is the comparative effectiveness fee the same thing?
Yes.
Yeah, as the patient center. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then in 2014 is really when we start having the, oh, gosh, what are we going to do moments, and I'll talk really very fast. That is when the state-based exchanges start, the no pre-existing condition exclusions go away. We have to certify coverage. There are, you know, on the positive side, there are some increased wellness program incentives, but we don't offer that at this point. Individual mandate means that everybody's going to have to enroll. No annual limits. We don't have very many of those on very many things right now. Required coverage for clinical trials is going to kick in. That could have an impact. You can't have waiting periods, and we don't. And the retiree reinsurance program ends if the money hasn't already run out, and I'd suggest that it probably will. So there are a lot of things that we don't know everything about, and we work with UnitedHealthcare to talk about what these impacts will be, and our CBIZ, who is our benefits consultant, to go through, and you know they give us giant books full of information. And if you want more detail on any of this stuff, just let us know and we'll get it to you. But we're kind of dealing with it on a year by year basis. The other thing that I would show you, just to give you an idea about how plan design changes can change things for us, on the UnitedHealthcare Executive Affordability Scorecard, on the page that talks about cost management overview. This is just for the first 2 months of 2011, and it shows us for the same prior period the year before. Because we added the $1,500 deductible and the high deductible health plan and made the few other minor tweaks that we made in coinsurance and the out-of-pocket, we've gone from a cost of $165 in round numbers per member per month to $127.79 per member per month. So plan change, design changes can make a significant impact. We're hoping that that trend continues, but that gives us 2 months of what that plan design change looks like. So as we go forward, we're looking at what our challenges and opportunities are. We're looking at plan design changes for January 1st, 2012, as we go through the budget process. We're looking at a possible exodus of our pre-Medicare population from the self-insured plan. If we can find a, there's one plan out there that will take them. And so we're looking to see if that's a cost-effective thing for us to do. We need to make sure that we can offer a low-cost core plan so that we can benchmark the cost-sharing pieces. Employees could choose to buy up. One of the things that we're talking about is if we keep the 750 plan, having employees pay to stay in that. And then all of the kinds of things on a defined contribution versus a what kind of benefit that they get. Our challenges are really going to be in 2014, sharing information with the state exchange so they can determine eligibility. There are tax penalties, and one of the big things in this is the unknown is a lot of what happens in 2014 is based on household income, and we don't have that information. It's not something that we collect from our employees and could become very difficult. So there is a lot out there that we don't know yet, but there is a lot that, you know, we're working on the year-by-year implementation. Mm-hmm. 2014 is going to be the first year when we have some major decisions to make. The other big thing in 2014 is their definition right now of those employees that are eligible to participate is anybody that works more than 30 hours a week. That could impact, we would have to offer insurance. That may change the way we look at temporary employees because if we have lots of temporary employees that work over 30 hours a week on a regular basis, and how many, is there an hour in the year?
They're saying
130 hours in a month maybe. So we're either going to have to change the way we use temporary employees, or we'll end up having to offer them insurance. So that's the thing I think that we see as the biggest thing out there that could really have an impact on how we do business.
Didn't one of your slides say that individuals were mandated to enroll?
Right, and that's 2014. Everybody's going to have to enroll in, everybody has to buy health insurance.
In this plan?
In the country, I think.
Anybody, yeah, everybody has to have insurance by 2014.
Everybody in the world, in the United States of America, yes.
My question is, what about dependent care? Are they mandated also to have coverage?
Everybody is mandated to have it.
So if we have for instance, you have a husband working for the city and the wife and children don't work, they're mandated to enroll in the city plan?
Well, that's probably one of the issues that are still
on what plan they have to do with the, because with the income things that are out there, with the household income, and there's a percentage of the poverty level, and there's a percentage of if you have to spend this much of your income on health care, then you go into the, you get a free voucher to go someplace else. I mean, it's just like, makes you beat your head against the wall trying to figure out what it means. So they might be required to be in our plan. They might get a free voucher to go to the exchange, depending on their income.
How will this all affect the dependent care we're paying for some of our employees?
We'll have to just watch it and see how many new dependents.
Do we know what percentage of our workers have dependents on the plan? So there must be lots of married people that maybe the spouse that works for the city is on the plan, but the other spouse works at MU and is on that plan. Do we know how many people that this is going to be an issue for, or an estimate of how many?
We have, it's about 50-50. We have half of our employees, it's employee only, and the other half is one dependent or, you know, a spouse or a full family.
Yeah, so presumably that's not really going to change because the people that work for the city and they're, you know, for whatever reason, they're the primary wage earner in the family or whatever, they're covering their family already. That's not going to really change anything. I guess I'm gathering that Gary's question is for the people, the husband and wife, the husband is insured here and the wife isn't insured at all. What is our responsibility?
And what's our mandate?
Yeah.
It hasn't been determined yet.
And it's, well, it's more a mandate on the individual to be covered right now than it is for us to cover them.
It's a mandate on the individual, and I came back from the Missouri CPA Society tax camp this December, and it's a really a complete disaster because the way the fine will be levied under current plan, the way the fine will be levied on the individual is the fine will be added to their income tax. Well, if it's a family of four making $50,000 and they can't afford the insurance, and then you tack on this $5,000 fine, which is added to their income tax bill, they're not going to be able to pay that either. So it's completely unclear how this is going to work, and they're trying to put a lot of the burden on the tax preparers, which is just a nightmare. I mean, as a service to our employees, anything we can do to offer insurance to everybody, you know, even if we have to offer it to temporary workers at our cost, that would be such a huge relief to those people.
Right, right.
And, you know, and this is actually one of the things I was, you know, kind of steaming about before lunch about the temporary workers is, you know, they're here, they're working, and then they have to leave after 9 months or after 1,500 hours, and then they have to, then they come back after so much time, and it's just, you know, it's really hard on the worker and it's hard on their family. And if there was some way to just stop that and recognize that, okay, we're going to have this cost, and even if we have to charge them 100% of the insurance bill, it would be nice if we could do something for them.
And I think at some point we're going to have to make the decision on, you know, what are our temporary workers and how do we treat them?
Because a lot of it's to keep out, to keep down headcount or just to beat the health insurance cost, and maybe it's our responsibility to insure our workers. You know,
the 50% who currently have dependent care health care coverage, are we participating in all 50% of those dependent care?
Are we participating?
Do you mean do we?
Are we giving them allowance to?
We have a subsidy for all of dependent.
For all 50% of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. What if someone wants to bring their family in on dependent care? Do we subsidize that one too?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Other questions? I mean, it's going to be a work in progress, and we'll provide you information as we go along on what it means to us. But there'll be some decisions that we're going to have to come to you to get your input and advice.
Mm-hmm. And do I understand this right, that under the 2011 changes, you've actually managed to reduce the cost per worker?
Yes, we have so far. Yeah.
Is that unheard of? That's pretty impressive.
I think that it is impressive, too. It's by adding those two other plans. I really like that it is. Just the few people that went into the other two plans, how much this has affected our bottom line. But like Mark Grace said, 2010 was a good year for us. So.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. We hope that, you know, the positive, you know, we just have 2 months of the 2011 year, but we're hoping to see that trend continue.
Mm. So to draw a what comes next year conversation, this shouldn't be a large part of the budget process this year. We think we've made good changes. Those seem to be benefiting the bottom line, so to speak. I don't think we'll have to come in with any big changes. We're trying to figure out what all the federal changes are going to do. I think we're getting a handle on that. Next year and the year after, I believe there will be significant change that will be needed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the hope is the federal level gets figured out in a more sane way than we see it happening so far, and then that will become clear about what our options are as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a great update, and I don't think we'll have to worry about it per se this year, but certainly next year and the year after, it'll be a big issue in the budget cycle.
Is there so much uncertainty that it doesn't make sense to be thinking about setting aside a reserve for this, you know, because presumably there will be like this one-time change to the new system, which is going to hurt a lot, and then once it's in, that'll be part of the ongoing cost. But is it just too uncertain to talk about setting aside a reserve?
I think it's pretty uncertain still, and in one respect, the best reserve we can have is to reach a balanced budget. and then we have our whole fund balance to mm-hmm. that we can use to underwrite some of the what may be coming.
Any other questions? Item is the stormwater issue.
Session 4, Stormwater. Aaron Daugherty, Chair of the Stormwater Task Force, will address the Council. And following Ms. Daugherty's comments, Mr. Mathis will briefly review a timeline and strategy for stormwater.
Hi. I guess I'd just be here to answer any questions you all have. Or do you just kind of want a summary of what we've been doing?
Could you repeat your name?
My name's Aaron Daugherty. We've been working for the last few months predominantly on the Chapter 12A, the redevelopment chapter of the Stormwater Ordinance, visiting some of that language to kind of resolve some issues that had come up when it went into effect. We've been through several drafts, getting a lot of feedback from area engineers and project managers, and I think we're getting somewhere. We're by no means complete, but that's where we've been working, and we spent a small amount of time on the stormwater utility. We met with the consultants, went through their proposal with them, talked about the various aspects of that, and at this point we have collective thoughts, but not conclusions. Essentially, the commission and staff are working really hard to find middle ground in both respects, and we haven't got there yet.
Middle ground is always the challenge, isn't it? Council has been dealing with stormwater for some time, and as you know, last month we pressed pause on the idea of moving forward with a big increase in the stormwater utility. So staff has taken your direction. We have met internally, brought in some of the some of the experts. Mike Hood has helped us sort of strategize about next steps. We're going to approach stakeholders in the community, quite a bit more research, and come back to you with a plan that sort of considers everything we're talking about today, by the way, with road needs, stormwater needs, et cetera, and really balance that out. And certainly the task force is going to have a lot to say about what that looks like. And of course, the county has also asked us to kind of come and put our codes next to theirs and see where the differences are and if there's a way to make them more similar. That certainly benefits us both in the sense that we can sort of minimize the amount of sprawl that happens, the amount of leapfrog development, you might call it. So in those ways, I see good things coming, but it is a process, and we're just beginning it in many ways.
What is the time frame on the Stormwater Task Force issuing a report? Is it early in the process still?
As far as Chapter 12A?
As far as completing your process and issuing a report?
Don, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah. We're working on the redevelopment side of it. We've got basically everything worked out but a couple of issues, and I think we're going to just probably agree to disagree and bring that redevelopment ordinance to you with staff recommendation and the Stormwater Commission's recommendations, where we're at. That'll probably be either a report this time or early in July.
Given a difference of opinion, I guess, will the ordinance come from recommendations from the task force with the staff objections, or will it be your recommendation with the task
force? The way I would say it, it would come from the commission with staff
comments.
Yes. We've kind of been attempting to draft an ordinance that meets both needs. That just hasn't been panning out for a number of reasons. So the approach we've decided to take at this point, and we have a meeting scheduled for next week or the following week, and our plan for that meeting is to have a list generated of the specific issues that have come to surface as important to the commission, and that we haven't necessarily found ground with staff. So our goal is to put together our thoughts of the best way that it could be implemented through the ordinance. And I mean, you know, John and the staff, they have a huge challenge called it has to be legal. And that's where we're running into problems. I mean, we spent our first month of meetings with the attorney in there, and we accomplished very little. And we just decided the only way we were going to move forward is if we just kind of put logic in the mix, and unfortunately, that only goes so far. So we hope to bring you a list of our recommended changes. I think we'll do that relatively quickly, a couple meetings, and we should have a pretty good idea of where we stand as a group.
Well, Mr. Glasscock is not arguing against logic, is he?
No, the attorney was.
No, we kicked the attorney out of the room.
And I have a question. Are we supposed to have something in our disc on stormwater? Because I just have session 3 and session 5, no 4.
No, there really wasn't anything to give you, so there's nothing there on stormwater.
Okay.
Yeah. More of a verbal update.
Yeah, we had a written draft of our thoughts about the utility that was provided for the previous meeting. I think you all have seen that, where Jay attended to answer questions. I have more copies of that if you want to see kind of our thoughts on the utility. And then as far as Chapter 12A goes, that what we'd have would be the most recent draft that the city has written up. That would be, you know, to do the scratched out changed version. You could see on paper what we've revised from the beginning to now on that.
I'll just say the goal with that is to encourage redevelopment, and right now the ordinance doesn't do that very well.
Right. To the extent at which it's encouraged is where we're getting.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Is the stormwater rate something you're looking at also?
It will be when we get to the utility. We're kind of focused back on 12A for now. Yeah.
That's one of the things that has slowed the process. We jumped to the utility and we put the redevelopment ordinance on the back burner. It's to get the utility out of the way, because we thought we were going to go in August, so we needed to get that done by May. And then, so we're back on this portion, and we want to stay there until we get it done now. So we're not looking at the rates.
So a new rate will be forthcoming sometime? Or a revised, maybe?
I think Mr. Mathis is going to discuss that a little bit later.
We are working on a staff level to do all the research that's been suggested and come back with a more sensitive plan to the economy, to the community, and so I would look for that probably honestly, we wouldn't be ready till about May next year. Because what we want to do is talk to all the stakeholders and come up with a plan we know works best with everyone, and then bring it back to you.
So until that time, the utility has no money, right?
It has some money. It has
very little,
about $1 million a year. But for the need, that's,
and we can't do much with that.
Right.
But I think we want to take into account the infrastructure task force and all the recommendations they are saying, and so we want to blend that together, I think, is what we're trying.
We are prepared to move forward the way we have been, which is we can deal with emergencies as they come up. If a failure happens, we'll get it fixed. But we're not at that level where we're proactively replacing infrastructure, so I think that's your point, and that's exactly where we are. We're not we're not chipping into the work that we need to do, but we are going to.
So we're going to push that back a year?
Probably take that long to get it all lined up, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We're actually ahead of schedule. We can take a break now, or we can move forward with session five and roll into storm or tourism. Move on? Okay.
Move on.
Session five, economic development issues. The first discussion item is tourism. Mr. Mathis.
Thanks. This is one where there, again, are no handouts, no presentations, but really just want to have a conversation with you in a public setting about tourism. This is something I mentioned in the State of the City. Again, my read is sort of new to town, and what I see and what I think might be interesting to explore. Clearly, tourism is a huge economic engine in Columbia. It does attract tourism, and whether that, and I'm using that in a broad sense, so whether that's a family bringing a student to the university, coming to visit, coming to homecoming, that sort of thing, all the way to coming to Art in the Park or other events, Roots and Blues, etc. So many of the city operations are dependent on sales tax. We do care about tourism, and proof of that is we have a Convention and Visitors Bureau whose mission is to foster that and to do things where we can to proactively make that happen. So there has been an idea kicked around to merge Convention Visitors Bureau and the Office of Cultural Affairs. I like that idea if no one loses. And let me stress, I've had a lot of feedback. I have a 3-inch thick pile of letters from the community. I don't think one of them supports the idea on the assumption that it would be a cut to the cultural affairs group. But that's not really what I'm talking about, or not really what I like about the idea of merging. So what I wanted to throw out today is what my thinking is, a couple of conversations I've had, and where I'm headed, and then get your input on that idea. The thing I like about the idea is you take the power of the professional sort of sales marketing team, the CVB, and you match that up with the power of our culture in Columbia. And quite honestly, the only thing that differentiates any city from any other city is its culture. We all have the same chain restaurants. We all have the same type of highways. You know, it's not very different. Now, because we have a major university, I think that puts us in the top 100, right? But the only other differentiator is culture, and that includes, and that's a big word, you know, the history of the city, you know, ballet, film, downtown, the vibe, you know. So it's a big word that means a lot of things. So the thing that I get excited about is this idea where you embrace both missions, and I see them both helping each other a great deal, really taking each other to a higher level of performance than we've seen. So rather than being separate, I won't call them silos, because they have interacted, they have supported each other, and continue to. But what I want to do is capture that and see how we can encourage that to go farther, so that the end result is we take really great local happenings and make them regional, or we take things that happen here that are regional and make them a national draw. So really just sort of up our game. And for example, that might take Art in the Park, for example. What can we do to make that more successful than it is? And I know that Diana, who organizes that, has done a fantastic job. I got to go to that recently. I forget, last weekend? Remember, it was very hot. But I was really impressed with the talent that she was able to attract to that event, and I think it's an incredibly well-kept secret that no one's trying to keep secret, right? There is marketing, and there are lots of folks that come through. So I was talking with Diana about that, and she said a few words that I thought really capture what I'm talking about in a much more eloquent way than I was. And so I'm going to use her words, and what she said is, so what you're talking about really is a city of the arts. Columbia should be a city of the arts. And I really loved that phrase, and her idea, of course, is how can you embrace the negative things? Let's take billboards on the highway and turn them to your advantage. So maybe you commission a piece of art and put it on the billboard, that sort of thing. So that's a perfect idea for what I'm talking about creating a marriage of these two entities and then moving forward. So I'm not talking about cutting a budget necessarily. I'm talking about taking the synergies and proactively focusing on ways to make both more successful. So what I'd like to do is approach both boards. I've talked to the chair of both boards and pitch them on this idea and get their thoughts. Ask them to take a month or two, think about what that would mean to them, what they could see happening. If they're unanimously opposed to it after that time, fine. Maybe there's other ways to move forward in a more coordinated way. But I would like to get that input before we say no or yes to the idea. So that's my approach I'm proposing, and I'd love to get your thoughts and reaction to that.
I'd like to know what you're thinking in terms of staffing.
Excellent. So I think the fear that the cultural arts folks have is that this would be a way to take them from 2.75 FTEs to 1.75 FTEs, right? That's not what I'm proposing. In fact, if we merge, you may end up with more than 2.75 FTEs focused on cultural affairs. The other thing it gives you is great backup. You've got, I'm looking at Amy, 12 total FTEs or 9 in CVB? Nine. So go from 9 to 12 with the merge. And so then if your mission becomes something that's more merged, what do people do? Probably they would look somewhat similar to what they do today, but where their focus is might be slightly different. So have backup. So right now, cultural arts, if, you know, three people, that's pretty thin. You can't get too much thinner than that on an organization. And so if someone's on vacation, maybe there's no forward momentum on a big project. If you merge, you could still keep forward momentum on a project. So backup is...
I know you probably have the same and more lists of letters and emails than I have, but uniformly they've been negative. And I think the concern is that... the Office of Cultural Affairs has done such an outstanding job up to now with such little staff, you know, Columbia being the first creative community in Missouri and a whole variety of awards. And the fear is that that strength and momentum and accomplishments will be lost in filling hotel rooms. So I think the sell is to show, because the Office of Cultural Affairs has different goals. I mean, there are some of those goals, but they're different goals. So the sell will be to show how we can continue to do what we've been doing so well. Marie Hunter basically has done so well in the past. Keep that strength and make it go forward. So that's the fear and the sell is to do that. And I know just talking with you personally, your goal is to make it stronger and to keep the previous mission and take it further. But people have talked to me about it will be difficult to get a director that understands and is good at both of those things, so the Office of Cultural Affairs doesn't get lost in the process or the strengths that they have now. So it's just purely filling hotel rooms. I, go for that, just that.
Speaking of filling hotel rooms, would this be the proper place to put a sports commissioner? Bring in
the it's a fascinating choice of words. In fact, I know that the CVB has been I would say brainstorming, maybe is not even strong enough. They've been putting a lot of thought into sports is a strength of Columbia, and the thought is, well, how do we play to our strength then? You know, how do we squeeze more out of that? And so that might be something that would be very helpful to that effort. I'll pass that on.
I think that is sort of a challenge that you have in threading this needle, because these cultural events are certainly good for Columbia tourism, as well as the citizens of Columbia. But if I'm in the Office of Cultural Affairs, and the commission that I'm on is trying to get 14-year-old boy soccer players into town, I'm now going to start worrying about your focus. So I think that the message has to be one of advocacy for the arts, understanding that sports tourism is very big and very important, and really probably a different mission and probably a different constituency. Maybe it shouldn't be, but you know, the reality is it might be different, because that regionally we're in an ideal setting for sports tourism. We've got the state games, we've got the university having events, so it is a big part of tourism. So I think it's going to be important to be able to separate the cultural activities from sports, and if you can combine the two in some creative ways, that would be great.
If you could,
right.
And I don't know, I don't have the answers. Let me say, I'm describing a future state. I think that would be great if we could get to, but I'm not sure how to get there. But
right.
But that's exactly one of them where, no one comes alone, right? That's the
right.
Great part about sports. They usually drag their whole family with them. If your family's like mine, not everyone is that turned on by baseball or football. And so if you can marry up something happening culturally with that of a sporting event, give the people who really aren't that into football something to do that weekend, we might have a real win-win across the board. And so that's exactly the kind of thing we need to think about.
It seems to me like the impetus for this was, of course, Marie leaving. But if we could remove that from it, and just look at it as if she were still here, and not to disrespect to her, just taking over her job duties. But if we could just say we're thinking of combining these two because we believe they can each help each other become better, then maybe it would help everyone feel better about the goal, which is to strengthen the cultural affairs offices by virtue of getting the word out about what they do in a more efficient way, and then it probably would, by virtue of making them better, help the CVB as well. So it seems like we just need to figure out the best way to maintain its identity, but utilize everything that we've got already in place.
In fact, I think that's going to be the interesting challenge, because if Marie were still here, or whoever it was were still here and was invited into that office, it might be a different thing than saying, okay, we're going to get a new person and move them into this new office. I'd agree with Barbara and you, and I don't know, Bob, if you also said this, but that my mail is 100% against this idea, that the belief is that the mission of fostering the arts is a different mission from the mission of marketing arts, and that people are very suspicious of the idea of merging these two offices. And so if we were looking at it from the perspective of Marie is still here and everything's working the way it's working, why would we combine them if everything's already working and people are coming to the events and CVB knows about the events and has the materials, has the information, and symbiosis with OCA to market the events, you know, why do it unless it's to cut the one, unless it's to go from 2.75 to 1.75? See, that's the suspicion to overcome. And I can't, I have to say, I don't quite get the sales pitch myself, so.
Well, really, it's I don't think anything's broken here, right? That's the first thing. But it's, can we do better than we have? And so I look at the Austins of the world and the Louisvilles, and I think, well, I think Columbia's doing well, but I have to admit, I think they're doing better at it, right? And it's because they embraced culture and said, how can we market this?
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. So,
yeah, yeah. So take Austin. You know, 15 years ago, they started calling themselves the live music capital of the world. Well, they certainly weren't then. that was a bit of an overreach. And I think there might be some cities that argue with that today. They probably are at this point. They have grown into that, and that's spread to other venues. It's now about film. It's now about tech as well as music. So that's kind of what I'm talking about. And I don't know how to get there. That would be really the staff and the boards working toward that. And so that's what my hope is, that I'll approach them, get their thoughts on it. If it really is not something that's really doable at this point, then play the course, but
yeah. Although, right, if you're stirring the pot, throwing in sports would be a great time to do it. This would be a good time to do it.
Do you have an opportunity to talk to Marie to get her thoughts about
I have
this?
A phone call scheduled.
That might be valuable also.
Well, she can help. You know, there's a clear line between fostering interest and providing people here with wallets to support. Because it, you know, the starving artist theme continues for folks who can't sell their wares to folks who don't know they're here. So I mean, I think there's an opportunity to help support them and keep everyone interested and help them learn what we really have here.
Well, yeah, based on my correspondence, then that's the argument that needs to be made.
At marketing the arts is fostering the arts.
I'm wired that way, right? And I'll tell you, one goal of Art in the Park is to sell art, right? It's certainly not the only goal, by far. A lot of it is to introduce people to arts, and so I think there can be more win-wins, and that's really what I'm shooting for. Not any kind of reduction of staff and all that.
I think you're correct in what you said. Drawing people to the event is very important. That's how you sell art. And the CVB is very good at negotiating hotel rates for events, which would help draw people to the event from out of town. If they keep their expertise in their arena, I think the marriage of the two would probably work. It would draw more participants to the events. I think that's what you've got in mind.
What I'm hoping for. Great. Any other comments about that? Let me just embarrass the two folks that are here. I think Connie and Amy, would you kind of wave? They've been keeping the ships pointed in the right direction and the sails furled while we're in this sort of uncertain phase. And so I really want to compliment them on continuing that. And to underscore my commitment to the cultural arts, I'm gonna ask Connie to be full-time support. She's been half-time to this point, until we get through the decision-making process. And then once we get through that decision-making process, we can go from there. They've both been doing a great job.
I'm going to suggest we take our 15-minute break, and when we come back, we will talk about the airport. 2:45.